Okay, my name is Katie Ringsmith. I am project director for the NN Cannery History Project. I'm here today with Denise Stutz in Palmer, Alaska. We're sitting in, what's the name of this
place? Turkey Red.
The Turkey Red restaurant store in downtown Palmer today. It was Monday, December 17th, 2018. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today,
Thanks
Denise.
Thanks for lunch, Katie.
Oh, you bet. Okay, so let's start by having you state and spell your full name, please.
So my name is Denise, D-E-N-I-S-E, Smith, S-M-I-T-H, Stotz, S-T-A-T-Z.
That was actually going to be one of my your second question, and what is your maiden name? So thank you for...
Same.
All right, so... First, let's talk a little bit about your biographical background. Where were you born?
I was born at Kanakanak, March 14th of 1957.
And
my
where,
folks are Roy and Harriet Smith.
Can you explain where Kanakanak is?
Kanakanak is attached to Dillingham. I mean, it's just down the road from Dillingham. It's where the Indian Health Service Hospital was located and where there used to be a village there.
Can you talk a little bit about Dillingham?
Well... Yeah, it was home for many years, home for my family from about the turn of the last century until my folks left in about 1964. I returned to Dillingham several times. It was always, the Nooshiegak is one of those places, if you've ever lived on the shores of it, you kind of are always called back. And so I returned to work there in the for the Native Corporation, or for the Health Corporation, a couple of different times, actually. And Dillingham was, when I was growing up, probably, maybe 500 or 600 people. It's the hub for the Bristol Bay region, for the villages to the south. And,
yeah.
And then the Naknek, King Salmon area, Leavelock area.
Okay, right. So can you tell me a little bit more about your parents? And can you state who they were? I walked on you last time you were about ready to
My dad
me.
Was Roy Smith. He was came to Dillingham in about 19... I have to work on this. Graduated high school in 1934, went to Southeast in 36. He got to Dillingham in 38. He was a pilot, big game guide, fisherman, ran a scow. Ultimately, we ended up in South Naknek, where he and my mom were the winter watchmen, and my dad was a beach boss and continued to fish, continued to trap.
When did you...
Mother was... Okay. My mom was Harriet Smith. My mom's association with the cannery was that she actually worked... 1943, she worked on board one of the first floaters that was there.
Can you explain what a floater is?
It was a floating cannery. It was one of the older, I mean, that's what they do now.
Yeah.
They freeze in floaters, but in those days they canned aboard floaters.
Right.
And if I'm not mistaken, those were old military ships. If I could be mistaken about that, but that's my recollection. And then my mom, well, let me think. She waited tables and she worked in the can loft and she... ultimately ended up being the floor lady for the egg house. Mm-hmm. Packed eggs, and she sorted eggs and worked very much one-on-one with the Japanese that were responsible for that, and
okay.
Was loved her work. She took great pride in that role. Very proud of it.
So before we get into the cannery history, I just want to make clear that we have been talking quite a bit about the APA-NN cannery, but the cannery that you're talking about at South Naknek is a different one. Can you talk a little bit about that?
My dad's association, the entirety of his career, was with Columbia Ward Fisheries. Libby McNeil, Libby was an, I mean, it goes by Columbia River Packing Association, Bumblebee Seafoods. You know probably more about that process. We still call it CRPA.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad fished for them from day one and then ran scows for them. And Mother and him and Pete Hyano actually had an interesting situation. They leased scows from Eacock, and then they would attract their own fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
And those fishermen delivered to my dad or to Pete Hyano. And then they they were in a little different relationship with the cannery than were many of the people that ran Scows, and they were just hired to run Scows, and then would derive their paycheck from the cannery, where Dad was working on a percentage, as was Pete.
Okay. And just kind of geographically speaking, where is Columbia Wards / Bumblebee located in relationship to the NN cannery?
Well, it's downriver.
Right.
Just past, there's Dobbin Specs. You know, there's what we always called NN APA,
right.
Alaska Packers. So there's APA cannery. Well, upriver there's PAF, then there's APA, then there was Dobbin Specs' little outfit, and then there was Bumblebee, and then down farther,
okay.
Diamond O and Diamond M, which were, by the time I was around, were they still had winter watchmen, but they were no longer functional canneries.
Right. So again, just before we get into the cannery history, I wanted to just mention a few historical events. And again, these events took place long before your time. But really what I'm looking for are stories or if, you know, they've been memories of that experience that have been handed down. And certainly I'm just kind of looking for your perspective on these events. And of course, the biggie is the Nova Rupta Katmai eruption in 1812.
Well, I hope that somebody at this table will take the time today when they get home to go to the Facebook, the wonderful social media that we all are so dependent on now, and read Trefon Anguson's little story that he tells about his grandfather, was Trefon's father, if I'm not mistaken, that actually when they felt the change in the earth, the shaking in the earth, he got people to prepare their bodarkas and get ready to leave. I hope that you'll read that and actually read that into the history, because it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
We all, you know, having lived there, of course, you're sensitive to the fact that there was Old Sevenoski, New Sevenoski, and then the village of South Naknek.
Right.
And South Naknek, in my mind, one of the things that was so unique about it is that you had people from fairly diverse background.
Mm-hmm.
We had people that had originated up the lake. We had people who had originated from down the coast. And then, so we had a blending of people in South Naknek.
Yeah, it's a crossroads.
More so, really, than a lot of places in Bristol Bay.
Was there anybody of Japanese heritage living there?
Well, I think everybody is...
Yeah.
The Anguson family has Japanese blood.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's what
One
of the reasons why I ask is I was at a presentation about Japanese, people of Japanese background who were interned under Executive Order Section 9066, and South Naknek was listed, and there was one individual who had been and I had no idea about
that
story.
Well, I do know that it would be worth your while to talk to the Hyano kids.
Okay. Yeah,
they were raised at Ecock, and I may be out of bounds on what I just said, but I would assume that when you talk to Trefon, he probably would tell you if there was Japanese blood in their family, because I remember that being spoken. I don't know I can't attest to any of that.
Yeah, no, but I think you're absolutely right about the fact that this is a cosmopolitan place. That this is a place that reflects.
Well, I know that the Hyano kids can tell you that they had. Their dad actually served in the military, but was forced to serve in the European theater.
Okay.
Because he had family that was interned at the time that he was serving.
He was probably in the 442nd Infantry, fought in Italy.
Yeah. It's very worth you investigating.
Absolutely.
And I would suggest, you know, Robert, Norman, any one of those kids would probably have some stories that they would be able to share. I don't have enough.
What about the 1919 flu pandemic?
Well, that's part of the history of our family. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Of course, it was a devastating situation. People died very, very quickly. It took a group of people that you would not expect. It took young, healthy individuals.
Yeah, people my age.
You would not expect that. Yep. I know several stories from having sat at the table with Mrs. Zimmern and Mrs. Harris, who talked about it with the great, you know, personal memory of it. They lost their mother to that. My Uncle Butch at the time, And I have to tell this from the perspective that I didn't ever know Butch Smith. I didn't ever have the opportunity. I think he died in 1957, if I'm not mistaken, which is the year I was born. But Butch had, for many years, several years, I should say, run dog team between the Pacific side of the chain and Bethel, running mail.
Wow.
Because there was open water there, he'd pick up mail and he'd take it up to Bethel. And that particular year, as the story goes, and I don't have this in writing, I only have it in oral history, Butch picked up the mail, and when he was going back, two of his dogs died, which was something unknown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he took good care of his animals. It wasn't that he was running them hard. They just died. And ultimately, when he came into Bethel, he went in the sled. He was riding in the basket of the sled, basically unconscious. He was very, very ill. The people in Bethel didn't want him in Bethel proper because they knew that he would bring this devastating disease, and they couldn't tolerate it. And so they assigned him to a woman whose son and husband had drowned a year or so before while hunting seals. And I don't know what her family name was, and in fact it's this project that has inspired me to consider going to the Juno archives to try to find that, because they were married later on. She took care of him and nursed him back to health, and in the spring, when he was strong enough to travel, she went with him to Bristol Bay, and they were married, and were married for a very long time. They lived up by Equock. They lived in Dillingham. They lived up river, but they also lived in Equock, and that's where the name Butch's Slough comes from. That was my dad's Uncle Butch.
Huh.
He was a very, very well thought of individual, and fished Bristol Bay.
Yeah. So one of the kind of other historical events that I think gets left out because of the overwhelming repercussions of the Spanish flu pandemic was that the salmon runs crash in 1919, mostly because of overfishing due to feeding the troops in World War
One. Interesting.
So are there any stories about, I mean, I imagine people were just so overwhelmed with the flu, but I'm just interested to see if that it was like a 1-2, punch.
I have nothing that was ever said to me about that at all. The flu story was important. The importance of the fisheries was discussed with me many times from my dad's perspective, but that was a World War II, and my folks were working on the Alcan Highway. Dad had a small crew of people, including Willie Chythlook. Excuse me, I said Chythlook, and I mean Kupchayak, from Togiak, and another group of people that were from the Bristol Bay area, and they went up and worked the Alcan. But the Corps of Engineers released them to go back to Bristol Bay because that was seen as a priority, was the production of fish for the feeding, not only of the troops, but of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always thought it was really interesting that we treat it with such a nonchalance now, but at one point you could be released from a very, what was deemed a very important project. I mean, think about the short time and the amount of manpower that they put into that highway.
Yeah.
But they released them to go back because it was more important.
Well, it was just important to feed people during the war, as it was to create
And salmon
create
was
access.
A way to feed people.
And salmon was a way to feed people. So I just have one more question about kind of the history. Going back to South Naknek, you mentioned, you have New Seven Oski, PAF, APA, NN, then you have Bumblebee, then you have the other two canneries, APA canneries, Diamond M and Diamond O. Are there stories about villages existing there prior to the arrival of the canneries?
I think when you fly that area, you can see evidence. I remember my dad pointing out evidence of where there had been villages. I don't know stories about them. Mm-hmm. I think people were somewhat nomadic, if you think about it. They would have moved. I don't have enough information to be of any value to you in that regard. I would think, again, some
very
of the,
little
the
of it
older
has actually
fellows.
Been archaeologically investigated because the canneries, the private owners, have maintained those, you know, that land for so long.
Well, just
so,
up the hill from Bumblebee, you know, where the new water towers were, the upriver side.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a people would frequently dig up there.
Yeah.
And kick up things.
Yeah.
You know, trade beads and ivory, various different things, spears, stuff like that. But kind of feel like I was, my dad in particular felt that you could never own anything in Alaska. It was not ours to be owned.
Yeah.
And my dad wasn't a person who collected other people's artifacts. He wasn't a great believer in it. In fact, that's one of the things about Butch Smith that was really interesting that I read about. You know, he traveled with Herdlicka. He was a fellow that took Herdlicka up the river. And
anthropologist.
Yeah, and he didn't like traveling with him. He didn't like him digging up graves. He felt bad about that. And I think that there's a lot about Butch's sort of teaching that stuck with my dad, that you just didn't touch other people's burial sites or anything of that nature.
Right.
So honestly, there's nothing. I mean, we left Bumblebee without a cup.
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing looking back at it, because a lot of people have, you know, they taken advantage of those old canneries and tore the hell out of everything, and my dad was not much for that.
Well, that's a good segue to the cannery in from part of this interview. So set the scene for us. When you imagine South Naknek, when you close
your
eyes.
Oh, you're going to make me cry. Don't do this.
When you have Bristol Bay in your head, what are you seeing? Paint the picture for us.
Oh, Katie. Well, I suspect that there are very few more Pollyanna people than me. And I lived at a time amongst people that could not have been better people. So my world, as it pertains to Bristol Bay, starts in Dillingham, a little girl that was sort of spoiled rotten. I came pretty late to my folks, you know. And so there was a whole bunch of old people that were really good to me. So it's all people. When I think about it, really, I think about summer days being in Eacock and picking those peas that grow along down there. And I think about being with Rosa Hyano and walking down and playing with the kids that were Jack and Kuno Savo's kids. And I mean, it's just all very positive. Going to the White House, you know, because they had Mr. and Mrs. Eckern had their place there, and my folks were on the scow. And, you know, we'd go out. And you'd have people tie up. My dad would tie me on the back end of the scow so I could watch the fishermen tie up. And you watch people. And you know, the names just come back just in incredible force in my mind. I think about just the people.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tragedy of Guy Grote Sr.'s passing when he was killed in an airplane accident, and my folks were convinced to move over to South Naknek, because at that point they wanted to have somebody that could fly out of South Naknek to Dillingham in the event of a tragedy or illness or whatever. And so we moved over there, and of course that was another community that just, I mean, maybe I was just a lucky little kid, but I got to be, you know, I got to be just a part of the community. And I think back and I just think of people. I think of Vera and Trifon in their warm, cozy kitchen and sitting and beading. And I think of Mrs. Harris and Mrs. Zimmon. And I think of Jack and Elfie and all their kids rolling through town. And I think of Annie Zimmon. I just think of people, one after the other.
And so one of the interesting themes that I find that emerge from these interviews is the experience of being a child in a cannery. You were a cannery kid.
It was pretty
kid.
Great.
Brad was, I was a cannery
kid. It was a pretty great
kid.
Place.
Yeah, so can
could
you...
could ride my bicycle up and down the boardwalks. And
how old were you for when you first went to South Naknek?
Well, South Naknek was my first experience with a cannery because my folks worked at Eacock, you know, for years.
Yeah.
And so my first memories really are walking, holding my mom's hand, walking up the dock up towards the galley at Eacock and getting donuts and going over and visiting where the waitresses lived. My mother would go and visit the women that were waiting tables there, and we'd get cleaned up and go up, and my mother would always, if there was a quiet time, Mom would always go up and visit with Rosa Hyano between times that there was fishing. So those are my first memories. I laugh about this because one of the memories I have that people can't really believe is, so I was on the scow with my folks, and I was a little kid, and so I was a pain in the butt, right? And my mother had a tiny, I mean, the kitchen on a scow is, you know, it's that big, it's so tiny. And so she'd say to my dad, get this kid out of here. And so I'd climb up into the wheelhouse, and my dad would be doing stuff, and then he'd have something else to do, and he'd get busy, and he wouldn't want me to be bothering him. And so he'd yell across that we'd be tied up next to Pete Hyano. And he'd yell over and he'd say, Pete, you have time for a kid? And Pete would say, yeah, go ahead, come on over. And oh my gosh. Thank you, Paul.
We just had a fellow walk in and hand Denise a book.
Oh, this is from, actually, it's really funny because this is made by the husband to Sharon Ingram, who is the daughter of Bill Ingram, Bill and Lillian Ingram. And Bill was my dad's fishing partner for ever,
nice.
The longest, longest time. And they made this beautiful leather-bound book for me.
Very kind.
But anyway, Dad would toss me over to Pete, and I would go in his galley, into his galley where Alec was, Alec Koliaha, who was from up the lake. And I'd draw and raise hell at their place for a little while, and then they'd send me back to my mom. So life for me as a little kid at a cannery was just a really positive and good thing. You know, all good things kind of flowed from the cannery. If you stop to think about it, it was the beginning of the season. It, you know, brought gobs and gobs of people, young people and people who'd been coming there for generations.
Mm-hmm.
It's where I was inspired to believe that I should go on to college. I mean, it seems weird, but you know, you're surrounded by young people that went on to be pretty great things. I mean, our dishwasher was a guy who later on went on to win an award as a physician in the state of Oregon. We had a guy named Robbie Law. I can say this now because everybody else is gone, right? We had this guy named Robbie Law who was this really awesome, super bright guy. And he did a little newspaper for a long time. And it was sort of a tell-all what was going on at the cannery. And it was pretty funny.
When I was a kid, I wrote one. I did.
I would love to say that I actually kept one of Robbie's, but I didn't. But they were pretty scathing and pretty interesting.
the rumor control. So the companies, Ward Cove, the Alaska Packers, PAF, again, upstream. Were there other major fish companies in Bristol Bay that you can think of?
Well, there's Nelbro, and, you know, Red Salmon was tied in with Bumblebee. There was Whitney Fidalgo. I'm trying to think. It was you guys also had Clark's Point.
Mm-hmm.
And
Peter Pan.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. I'm not getting them all right off the bat. But, yeah, there were a lot of companies, and people had tight affiliations with their companies. It was a source of security, really. In those days, if you stop to think about it, there weren't cash buyers. There were, and there were good years and there were bad years. They certainly weren't as, it seems to me like every year now is just better and better and better. But I remember the cycle, and I remember people planning around that cycle. You knew that you were going to have, you know, you were going to have a trough. And so people would buy food ahead and plan during their good years. But there were also folks who had maybe, you know, you could have engine trouble and end up with a lousy season, not through no fault of your own, but just a boat breaking down or whatever. Right. And the cannery that you were tied to would, you got fuel, food, the basics were provided for. Sometimes even I remember when Dad would get done at the end of the year, he'd be billing out the cannery and there'd be people who flew back, for example, up the lake. And this year, instead of them being billed, it would be billed to the cannery because maybe they had had, I mean, it could be other things. I mean, there could be a drowning. I remember a particular instance like that where somebody that, you know, had been, or a guy had been hurt, or, you know, there could be any number of reasons why the cannery would step in and provide for people.
Yeah, actually, during the Spanish flu pandemic, you had people who survived. And I think that's when the spring fall crew emerges, because mm-hmm. the superintendent writes in his report that people were given year-round employment mm-hmm. because of the the hit they took with the flu. So that,
and then the fisheries, you said too, mm-hmm. went kaboom.
Yeah, right.
Well, so, we had a wonderful crew. I mean, Bob Hodgson and and Mitch, and yeah, they were pretty great guys. And then there were people that were part of you guys' program, Freddie Grindle, for example.
Yeah. Well, and David Hodgkins,
David
I would
Hodgson.
Imagine.
Oh, yeah. David yeah. and Bob, young Bob. Yeah, and Freddie would come down and work on equipment because that was his expertise.
Oh, he
knew. He was brilliant.
Yeah.
And, my mother's table was never empty of people to visit with.
Just really quickly, when you mentioned the lake, are you talking about Iliamna or are you talking about Naknek?
Iliamna Lake.
Okay, Iliamna. Yeah. So I think of it as
we had that. Quite a few people that came down from up there that fish for bumblebee, Nundalton people.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about work, cannery work. When did you start working for the cannery?
When I was 14. I worked in the egg house with my mom, and I helped her build boxes upstairs, and I hid from the state of Alaska when they came to do their little run through. Yeah, my mom said, for God's sake, don't make a sound or we'll all be in trouble.
So talk about working in the egg house. What was that?
That
like?
Was what I started. That's what I started with. My mother was excellent at any job she did. She was a super hard worker, and she had gone in to. She used to wait tables before that. Well, first she was on the. You know, she was on the scout with Dad for years, and she cooked for a huge crew of guys. And then she, when they moved to South Naknek, she waited tables for a few years, but then they needed somebody to build those little boxes that they put the salmon eggs in, little wooden boxes. And so Mama did that in the spring. She'd build thousands of those boxes and have them all stacked and ready for them. You know, one down, two up, one over. And that's how she stacked them, and she'd keep track of them. And then in the summer, she would go down, and her job, she met with the Japanese early in the morning. And they would tell her the specifics of that day, time-wise, etc., what their expectations were. They would then go sort of behind their little, they had kind of a little wall, and they would do the brining of those eggs. And then when they were put on the belts, my mother sorted number ones. She was the person who took the tops for the finest pack.
Why was that so important?
Well, it was their economy. It was everything to them.
So why were the Japanese there in the first place? What was the purpose of the egg roll?
Well, the egg roll had a large value in the Japanese market as food.
Yeah.
And the Japanese really were the last, in my mind, the last real investors in the canneries. Mm-hmm. If you stop to think about it, yes, they did put some freezer plants in, but boy, the investment that went into those egg houses was dramatic.
Yeah.
I remember that being an enormous change because, before, when I was a kid, the eggs just went out.
Egg grinder.
Well, yeah, and just were gone. Seagulls ate them.
Yeah.
So when they came and they began to do this work, Mother served in a couple of different roles. She was a hostess to them often in sort of helping to make them have a comfortable place because they had their own bunkhouse. They wanted. That was part of their contract with the cannery. And then Mother would meet with them, and then every day she would sort these number one, the finest tops. Mm-hmm. They would go into these blue baskets, and then she would hand those. They would be handed to me. And I did the tops on all the boxes for
that's really important.
15 million hours a day at my mother's beck and call. It was truly a hard job. And then she would inspect. every so many boxes, she would inspect them, and those boxes were what they were going to put out for viewing mm-hmm. when they went back to Japan.
Yeah.
And for many, many years, they were award-winning
product.
Pack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So men typically did not work in the egg house.
No,
so
women
were pretty central to not only that part of the process, but as you point out, that part of the process was central to all of the cannery by the early 1980s. So was it typical to have women work in the canneries?
Bumblebee had women in the canneries as long as early as the mid-1970s. Prior to that, there were not a lot of women at the cannery. There were waitresses. There was one woman that worked in the office.
Mm-hmm. Laundry?
Smitty ran the laundry. I'm trying to think of who else. There was somebody else, and I'm trying to think of who it was. There was a woman that came up and worked in the cannery store one summer. Mm-hmm. But I think she was a fisherman's wife.
Okay.
Actually, and I think she was there more by happenstance than otherwise. And then ultimately, you know, we had Jeannie Fitzgerald was our net boss.
Wow.
At Bumblebee. Huh. Yeah, she was the net boss way back when.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's Jeannie Fitzgerald. She was married to Mike Fitzgerald from Kodiak. She was a really lovely woman, too.
What about the mess hall?
Yeah, all the waitresses, other than at the Filipino galley, which was men.
And that is an extraordinary job, I would think.
Waiting tables?
Well, working in
we
that.
We all aspire to it.
Right, but that mess hall, because you are ultimately feeding that entire workforce.
No doubt.
Yeah.
It was hard work.
Yeah.
So that's what I aspired to. And ultimately, when I was 17, I just blew up. I couldn't work for my mom another day. She was miserable. Well, my mom was like, she was nuts, kind of. So you'd get done with this incredibly long day. I mean, you'd be on your feet for 18 hours,
yeah.
right? And then my mother would be walking up and she'd say, oh, look at that. The tide's coming in. Dad's going to be home. Let's go up and do a little load of laundry. My mom had a Maytag. There's no little load of laundry. So the laundry goes in, then it gets wrung out, then it gets wrung back out of the. Then you take it out and hang it up. It's like, Mom, I can't breathe, much less do this with you. So as soon as I could move on, I was moving on because she was a slave driver.
So tell me about the schedule, peak of the season. What's your day like in the mess hall? How do you feed that many people?
Well, you
have
the tables are assigned to you. So
okay.
we had eight tables each, and there were eight guys to a table.
And what was the meal
so
schedule?
So you would go in, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be mistaken, I think you served breakfast at 7:15, if I'm not mistaken. And everything was done family style. So you would take out the French toast and the eggs and the fruit. For example, that might be an example, but already on the tables were the syrup and the mm-hmm. butter and all that. And you would take, you know, you'd put your trays on, you'd carry three trays to a side and one in this hand, and you'd put them on, you'd start at the far end, get your tables set. The guys would all come in, they'd sit, they'd eat. They would, at that point, leave. And we had a setup where they actually took their plates and scraped their plates and put their plates and spoons, and then they could be rolled into the dishwasher. Some places didn't do that. Like if you had the machinists, the carpenters, when they had the blue room and the green room, and those rooms, they didn't pick up their stuff. You picked up their stuff for them. That was under union contract.
Okay.
And I only waited in the blue room and the green room a few times. Under Warner Leonardo, he moved everybody out into the main dining room. So there was a beach table, there was a carpenter's table, there was a machinist table, there was a superintendent's table, and he had the people from the office with him. And then, you know, just from there on, it just went back. And I'm trying to think, I think we were 16 tables deep.
Okay, yeah.
Four rows, does that sound right?
Yeah.
32, 64, maybe it was less than that. Seems like it was a lot of people.
So you had the breakfast, then
And then you had mug up, 10 o'clock mug up was served.
What is mug up?
Mug up was a snack. It was coffee, usually something cold to drink there was water at least. And then donuts at the 10 o'clock, typically. Mm-hmm. Donuts, maple bars, cookies, something like that, big trays of cookies. if you were working up on top, up away from the cannery, so because Bumblebee, you know, is really set up like that, where there's there's sort of an upper level and a lower level. The cannery's down low. They would have maybe two tables up on top for people who, the guy who was at the hospital or whatever, and then everything else went down on these behind jitneys down the hill, and it was just served. People would just step up, just get in line, and then take their food.
Yeah.
And then at noon, we ate it. The whistle went off at 12. People went up and got washed up, and then 12:15, they'd eat again. Same thing. So this time it might be, anything from, it would generally be a full hot meal, though. Yep. It would be, you know, vegetable, starch, meat, bread, dessert. It was a full meal.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 3 o'clock, there was another mug up, same story. And then at 5:15, there was another meal. And then at 9 o'clock in the evening, there was another mug up. And that depended on how busy things were. If you were canning, if you were still in process, that would happen down on the dock. Then you'd have a midnight meal. I don't ever remember having a 3 a.m. mug up, but I know that they did them. My mom served them.
Yeah, when the boats were coming in, probably. Yeah.
I don't remember it because I'm pretty sure I was probably unconscious by then.
So
my favorite story about my personal life is that when I was 18, something happened in the galley that my dad didn't like. My dad was a beach boss and he watched it happen. And my dad had kept me pretty protected. But somebody had made a comment that dad didn't like. And so he just came back and said, we're going. So he walked me out and he walked me up just one building up to where the Filipino galley was. And in those days at Bumblebee, there was the Filipinos and the native crew ate together in that facility. And the meals they brought, the Filipinos had their own cooks. When they came in under contract, they had their own cooks. And I think they brought three cooks just in case. And they had truly fabulous food. I mean, it was really lovely. They had food of their choosing. It was the kinds of noodles that they ate, the meat the way they ate it. It was really lovely.
Yeah.
And my dad said to this fellow whose name was Rudy, "Rudy, I want my kid to work here with you." Well, at that point there had been no women work in that galley, to the best of my knowledge. And Rudy was a friend. My dad and Rudy had a good working relationship. And so he permitted me to go in and wait tables. Well, it only took about a few days before. Oh, I know what was interesting. I was going to tell you this. So Rudy said, "Well, we have our own waiters." And my dad said, "Well, Denise would prefer to wait on the native kids anyway, so let her do that. That'll be good." And so that's what I got to do. And these guys were great, you know, because they were people that I was super comfortable with. And they were a lot of kids from up the Bethel area, really nice young people. And so it only took about 3 or 4 days before I started talking to the other young people around the cannery about how great the food was up there. Well, within just a few weeks, we had all the young hippies were eating up at the other galley because the food was way better. So that was one of the first big migrations at Bumblebee and sort of boundary changes, if you will.
And I was going to ask you, too, about gender relations, and that kind of hints a little bit at that, is some of the perhaps older fellows weren't so inclined to not only have women around, but certainly how to treat them.
Well, it changed. I mean, a lot of the older gentlemen were absolute gentlemen. They were, you know, they were fathers and husbands, and they were genuinely polite and kind.
And then also you were talking about just the diversity of the crews.
Oh,
I mean, the Italians,
fabulous.
The Scandinavians, the Filipinos. And it was extraordinary from a 16-year-old kid perspective.
It was awesome. I mean, it gave me the desire for travel. It gave me the desire for education. I think a lot of who I was, or who I am even today, certainly 90% of who I am came from being raised in an incredibly loving village. And I say that meaning the whole Bristol Bay area, because I was, you know, I spent time in Good News, I spent time in Dillingham, Naknek, blah blah blah. But I feel like that's a really big piece of who I am.
Yeah.
And then a lot of it, you know, there's little things that filtered in from being around people who had lived overseas and people who got education that was kind of beyond my imaginings at that time. And I remember there being a certain expectation amongst the young people who were a little older than me, like when I was 13 and 14, they'd say, well, you know, do you want to go to college when you get older? And of course, at some point you say, sure, because not because you really know that that's what you want to do, but because that's kind of their expectation.
So I just want to talk about one more subject area, and that is the relationship between the cannery and the community. So first of all, I want to talk about the relationship between the companies. You're Bumblebee, I'm APA. What was the relationship between these two rival companies? Was it cutthroat, or was there a sense of cooperation as well? I know one time they boardwalked, for example, and then you had the APA canneries on the other side as well. What was that like?
Well, my experience may not be reflective of everybody's experience, certainly, sure. But I'll tell you what my experience was. I never had a sense that there was any great animosity between the people. I always think there was respect. I think there was competition, and I think there was also cooperation. I remember when there were a couple of times that I remember major equipment problems happening that could have stalled everything, and a machinist from another cannery came and was able to help resolve the problem. I also remember that there were stories about how people would gather in the lower 48 during the winter. I mean, I think they did things together. I think they had meetings and golfing and things that were kind of outside of
the cannery
world, you know. Yeah. But I never, Northwest I'm sure that there was a true competition. I'm sure there was a sense of competition. And I also think that there was some complementary kinds of behavior in terms of when one cannery would develop, you know, maybe the first real egg house that went in with, you know, systems that were a little different for delivering the eggs on these belted systems. I think everybody was watching. I think there was, what would that be? Not imitation, I guess, if not imitation, at least cooperation and looking at those systems. I know there were negative attitudes that came out a little later, you know, accusatory comments about like price fixing and stuff. And I've always thought it was kind of ironic, because if I have to move 5 pounds of a product from, you know, from point A to point B, and then 5 miles up the river, I have to move that same volume of product from that point to point B, there's a certain cost related to that, and you're producing. I guess I don't know how in the hell you wouldn't have some degree of price fixing.
Yeah.
But I think that whole conversation was very deleterious to the whole situation. I think when you see people as being cooperative and pleasant and having a common goal, that's one thing. It makes you able to work together well. And I think when you start seeing people as gouging and, you know, negative, then I think that I don't think that did anybody any good.
One of the big memories I have as a little kid is going to the Bumblebee store. The early, you know, mid-1970s, the store at NN had closed because, my dad started as a storekeeper. That's what he did.
I well remember that, actually. Katie, I'm older than you.
So tell me a little bit about the store.
Well, let me first tell you a little something about a handsome blonde, looked like a surfer, that was your dad. Never, always walking, or not walking, always running. I don't think he ever walked, did he? I remember Gary in that way, and I hope that as he, I'm sure, listens to your work, I hope that he remembers that people remember him that way.
Yeah, as Trayvon said, he was the superintendent in tennis shoes.
He was a pretty charming young man. Yeah, very charming. The store was my favorite thing. At Eacock had a fabulous store. When you walked in, it was an old building. It was a beautiful old building with wood floors and wooden counters. It was lovely, and they had everything you could imagine as a little kid.
So what kind of things were they still?
Coats and sweatshirts, and actually my first Neil Young album was purchased in Eacock.
Nice.
I still have it. The Bumblebee store, the new store that was built up on the hill, was built after the fire.
Mm-hmm.
And that store was absolutely filled with everything from, clothing, good socks, boots, household items. They brought in everything. They would just bring in, and they had a huge storeroom that everything resided in during the winter when they took it off the shelves. You know, big stainless steel bowls and the things that you use for everyday living.
Right, because what you had in the cannery, you had a provisions warehouse that mm-hmm. held food for the mess hall and also mm-hmm. food for the fishermen. Then you had your stock room, so mm-hmm. if machine parts and stuff like that. But the store was really to help, you know, support the community. You could buy everything from traps to
birthday cards.
Yeah, birthday cards.
It was everything. Yeah. I can just think of the fellow who ran our store, who was Dick Aho. He was from Astoria, and I can still visualize him and the enjoyment that he took in setting everything up. And I would go up when I was very young, maybe 9 or 10, and I would work days and days to help him set up the store before things opened. And then there was a big dry room that things were stored in, and then there was an area that was a cold room that, you know, household things could be stored that wouldn't be a problem. But good soap and, I'm just trying to think of everything. You know, they sold everything.
This was really the way that that especially for the local communities, was the first time they were really having access to these type of commodities that came from other places.
Well, more so in South Naknek than, for example, in Dillingham. Right. I mean, Dillingham had everything, but certainly in South Naknek, the store, you know, I remember
ammunition
when...
for hunting.
Virtually everything.
Yeah.
I mean, clotheslines, clothespins.
Christmas cards and decorations, huh?
No, that wouldn't have been at Bumblebee, but maybe up at you guys' store, sure, because during the winter... When I was young, that store would be open a few hours a day.
Do you remember that store?
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
Filled with all kinds of good stuff, too.
Yeah.
Wrapping paper, I remember that. Right. I remember, and I think Brownie actually opened it. He used to open it up when he was the...
So when you walked in, what did it look like?
Well, you went up the stairs.
Yeah.
There were steep stairs, and you walked in, and there was a counter on your right-hand side with big windows behind it. And an old-fashioned cash register,
mm-hmm.
really old-fashioned cash register. And then that's where candy and stuff was, as I recall. And then the walls were lined with things. There was all kinds of stuff. You know, it's hard, everything from soup to nuts, pretty much. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was... So now, after 20 years, I can say this. So in a few days, I close down. I step away from a business I've owned for a long time. And people laugh about the way it's stocked because it's so grossly overstocked. And I think a lot of that just comes from being raised in South Naknek and being raised in the canneries and loving the cannery store.
Yeah. No, I can see that. Absolutely. So what about, you talked a little bit about healthcare. We talked about the flu. There's the hospital at the South Naknek cannery. Did Bumblebee have its own health care, or did you ever happen to use
clinic.
The NN Cannery Hospital?
Oh, yes. Yes, did? I did. I can't remember his name, but the tall, slender doctor who was there. I should remember his name.
I have a scar here because he stitched me up there.
He was really a talented man. He could do everything. I was seen for a couple of different things. One was a suture, suture situation. One was a dog bite. I can't remember other specifics. I remember driving up there, taking people up there a couple of different times that had to be seen. We had a nurse at our facility, and there was a darling little clinic. I've always wondered what's happened to it. There was a bed. There was a place where if somebody needed to be held overnight, they could be. That your facility had an amazing array of tools. I mean,
The x-ray machine's
still
there. An
amazing array of tools. Well, you had stuff like forceps that were designed for the removal of, when there was a fetal demise.
Oh, really?
They had everything.
Wow.
It was...
Well, that was the place, even on the north side. It was, most of, Dillingham was...
What was his name, the old fellow that... I wish you could remember his name. Junior Annie would remember his name. It'd be nice to get that.
Yeah, that's important because I think that hospital plays a big part of
it. He was quite a fascinating fellow. He was very calm and
he saved a lot of bear attacks.
Anyway, it'll come to somebody. It won't be me, but somebody will remember his name.
So, the cannery and the communities, I think. How would you describe that relationship?
I think it was mutually respectful. I have a hard time. I know that we live in a time when people want to dredge up history that I think is often unnecessary. I'm sure that there are negatives. I'm sure that there's somebody that you will interview that will have everything negative to say. What I believe is that it was a respectful relationship. And my recollection is as a child, again, because I left... as an adult, I left when I was, 24 maybe? So beyond that, I can't speak to it. But I know that in the fall time, the canneries would make a point of leaving things that could be used by the families who might have the greatest need. And my dad was assigned to ensure that that was delivered, not in one bulk, but over time, so it would not be wouldn't go to waste because of lack of refrigeration or lack of whatever. And he did that diligently. They cut grass up on the hill at Bumblebee so that those old horses would have something, they just were hay belly, because
there was a... Up there?
Don't you remember the horses in South Naknek?
No.
Cliff Johnson had horses.
I have no idea.
Are you filming me?
No, just for personal,
Cut. But, anyway, and then at Christmas time, I remember there was a great effort to ensure that the fruit that was sent in, which was, Harry and David's, it certainly wasn't junky food. It was high quality, beautiful pears and oranges that would be sent in and ensure that every member of the community had something. Johnny Saville would always, Johnny and Carville always made sure that there were stockings. So the canneries worked with the people and the people worked with the people and the people worked with the canneries, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I was insulated from what might have been a different reality, but I certainly always felt like there was great respect shown people. I remember that when I was living in Astoria, I was living with the superintendent of the cannery, and there had been a tragedy, and I remember that there was an instant effort to ensure that something was done for the family. I think you can make anything the way you want it to be.
Sure. So just starting to kind of conclude here, but what do you think is the most important job, role, responsibility of the local community in the cannery scene, in the cannery production? So in other words, we talk a lot about the role of the cannery influencing the community. How would you describe the importance of the community in the success of the cannery?
Well, certainly the fishermen that were part of, that went out and caught the fish and turned in a good quality fish and sold to the canneries. That was certainly an important, very important thing. Some of the young people that served in roles working for the canneries were important. Anytime you hire someone, you want to ensure they're going to be there the whole season, they're going to be reliable, they're going to do all that. I think we never had trouble at all with people vandalizing anything down at Bumblebee, ever. I don't think there was ever a single thing that was stolen or vandalized during the winter. There was a, you know, I keep going back to this word respect. I think there was a mutual respect, and I think there was a mutual dependence. Mm-hmm. Maybe dependence, maybe respect derived from dependence. But whatever it was, there was certainly that. Mm-hmm. And I think that you know, I know that the good fishermen, the people who showed up and produced were deemed very important. They were known by individual name and they were known by family. And I certainly remember conversations around our table. I wasn't a part of those conversations, but I was listening when Mr. Leonardo and my dad would talk about, for example, getting certain people from leave lock down, or you know, what equipment or what materials somebody had requested to make sure that they got them.
People really did take care of those canneries. I mean, you hear the word caretaker, and care is very much a part of what they did.
Well, I can tell you that from where I sat, my dad took his job really, really seriously. I certainly know Carville and Johnny did. I mean, Jack Myers and they were, you know, their cannery wasn't even any more operational, but they weren't gone for long periods of time. Somebody was always there. There was, you know, there was always care of everything.
Yeah.
You know, Pete and Rosa Hyano, I mean, they were at ECOC for years.
As we're kind of, you know that we're focusing on an exhibit about the story of cannery people. What do you think is the most important thing that we need to share so that people from Kansas, people from Texas, people from China, people from California can understand and appreciate the story of the cannery people? What is it? What do we need to say?
The vast number of people that were associated with them. Mm-hmm. So I think it needs to be, I think at some point there needs to be a picture like an aerial that shows a cannery, all the buildings with people scurrying hither and thither, the boats lined up at the dock, you know, all the people, 2 to 3 people on each of those boats. Because when I think back on the vast number of people that would just descend on Bumblebee in the matter of a few days, you know, because Dad flew, so he was flying people, and they were flying 4 airplanes at a time, just boom, 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 boom. Six people to a plane. They would take all the luggage down and to Red Salmon, put it on a scow and bring it across. They would sometimes, Shawbacks would sometimes take down loads of people and put them on the scow if the weather was marginal. Just the sheer number of people and the sheer number of people who did it again and again and again, year after year, generations of people who were associated with it. And then the other thing I think that would be hard to show, Katie, but I wonder if there's not a way, cinematically at least, to show the quieting of those places. And I mean the long-term quieting. Because for somebody like me who was raised there, it's very hard to imagine Bumblebee the way it is now. It was so vibrant.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I just want to ask you one more question. And I waited for this one for last for apparent reasons. But you have talked quite eloquently about certainly the people. And many of those people aren't around anymore. And how do we remember them?
Well, you get people to say their names again and again, and I think it's very important also for us to have a mechanism of demonstrating who the, you know, their presence, and that's why this cork project that you guys are doing is so important to me, because if you were to have a cork for every man, woman, and child who was a part of that industry over the years, can you just imagine what it would be like? I mean, you could run your fingers down it and look at names. If I were to start today and just say the names of people that I knew and that I cared about, I would be here for a week. I mean, I think about all these people. And I think that whatever you do here, that will give their children and grandchildren a chance to know the importance of the role that they had is valuable.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. And
not a problem.
We'll get
Pretty
back to you.
Delighted to get to do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Was there anything that I missed that you think you
I think you drug it all out of me.